Hello, welcome to your meditation practice as part of the Open Heart Project. My name is Susan Piver. I'm very happy to sit with you. We're going to meditate together for about 10 minutes shortly, but first I want to continue sharing some thoughts about the three yana journey. Yana means vehicle, and the three yanas refer to the three main cycles of teachings that comprise the Buddhist path. The first cycle that we talked about is called the Hinayana, which is often translated as lesser vehicle, but that sounds like it's a less important vehicle, and that is absolutely not true. It would be more appropriate, accurate, to define it as the foundational vehicle, the teachings without which we're all going to be spinning our wheels, because we have to get on the path somehow, and doing so is much more than what we think the path is or should be. And in any case, there's millennia of great teachings and great wisdom that describe how to get on the path. So we don't have to invent the wheel and reinvent the wheel ourselves. So the foundational vehicle teachings focus on basically what we need to get going. And these teachings focus on things like simplicity, like we can't be on six paths at once, or study this kind of teaching and then glue on this other kind of unrelated teaching. And we can't try to practice all the things at once, or even to say something like, I will practice every day for the rest of my life is too complicated. I will practice for the next week and see what happens. Let's keep it very simple. That's of extraordinary importance, not because it is less stressful, although it is, but because it engenders clear seeing. When we smush things together too much, it's hard to see clearly. So simplicity is a key aspect of this first cycle. We're going to go on to the second cycle in a moment. But just a brief recap. Another important foundational quality that is emphasized on the whole Buddhist path, but most particularly in the Hinayana, is called discipline, which doesn't mean beating yourself up to get yourself to do the things you'd really rather not do. It simply means coming back. Can you come back to what's important to you, to your commitments, to yourself? Whether the gap is a minute or a day or a year, do you know how to come back? That's a good way to think about discipline here. And the third quality is called renunciation, which doesn't mean giving up all the things that are fun and only doing all the things that are not fun. Renunciation here means something more like, what is non-essential that you can give up? What are you doing? Who are you relating with? What are you concerned about that actually is not essential to your spiritual development, to your inner life, to your self-expression, to your discovery? What can you let go of? Is a way to think about renunciation. And when we are able to do these things, we're able to get on the path with some sense of simplicity and discipline and renunciation, there's a sense, perhaps, that we're settling down, not settling for, but we're settling into a kind of a groove. My practice is starting to take root. Some days it feels that way more than others, for sure, but when there's this general sense of, I'm in. I saw the door, I walked through the door. I may or may not know where I am right now, but I'm in. Something happens within us as human beings, I've noticed in myself and others, because it seems to be organic, which is we start looking around for other people. We start wanting to connect. Our hearts soften because we're not as graspy and needy about getting on the path because we're on. So it's not like everything's perfect, but there's a sense of opening. And the second cycle, Mahayana, translated as greater vehicle, offers teachings and practices about that opening. Now, greater vehicle doesn't mean better vehicle or advanced vehicle. It means, perhaps, this is my definition, where are you in the greater world? Now that you've found yourself in, to some degree, big or small, within your inner world, where are you now in the bigger world? Who do you want to relate to? How capable or willing are you to love? What touches you? How do you connect? How do you offer things that are of benefit in this world? The greater vehicle, the Mahayana, covers all of these things and more, and offers very profound teachings about how to love. I had a book on Buddhism and the Enneagram. And if you don't know what the Enneagram is, it doesn't matter. But it's just basically a way of understanding yourself and others. And it posits 9 ways of being in the world. And what I've discovered about this, and this will relate to the Mahayana in a moment, is that when I discovered my way of being in the world, or type, which is, I don't like that word, but that's what it's called, I suddenly saw myself in a different way. I saw that some of the things I'd been beating myself up about and wishing I could be were actually not in my wiring. Some of the things I was beating myself up about are just ways I am that are not good or bad. But I had been wishing I was someone else for quite a few decades, let's say. So when I discovered, oh, this is actually my wiring, I felt a kind of relaxation. I stopped trying to force myself to be wired like other people. And that gave me much greater compassion toward myself. Further, when I discovered other people's types or ways of being, my first reaction was not, oh, what's your problem? But it was more like, oh, that's you. That's how you are. That's how you are. That's how you're wired. I softened towards them and gave up, for the most part, having some sense of demand that they be wired like me. So, and the point I'm trying to make is not everybody should study the Enneagram, although I do think they should, but that space is really essential in general. And in all the Mahayana teachings, they often focus on introducing a note of spaciousness, a kind of letting go, and not holding on so tightly. That is the seed syllable of compassion itself. So can you create some space around the way you view yourself and others? So that's something to contemplate. In our meditation practice, of course, we practice this over and over again. And if you've never meditated before, don't worry, we're going to sit together shortly and I'll go through the whole technique. But for everyone else, you sit down. Oh, here I am. You let your attention rest on the breath. Then you space out, usually at some point. And you notice that you're thinking. And then you let go. And there's a space. And you come back to this breath and the next breath and so on. So every time you let go, you introduce a note of spaciousness. And that's what I'm talking about when I say space is the root of compassion or the seed syllable of compassion. You let go of your habitual views, your insistence that things be a particular way, although your insistence is important. So I'm not saying ignore it. But when we can let go, even for a moment, to see and feel what's actually happening, not what we wish was happening, we soften. And we feel less insistent on our way. And that capacity to lessen insistence is extraordinary. If you have some experience of doing this, if you have any sense of how to do this, you're doing something quite ordinary in one sense, but you are not an ordinary person. Because most of us, myself included, have difficulty with this notion. So it's a practice. We practice letting go, letting go, letting go, not to shoot off into outer space particularly, but to be present. Because when we're absorbed in our thoughts, we're present to our thoughts, not to each other. And I'm not saying your thoughts are unimportant. They can be quite important. But to let go is essential to this second vehicle, this second step along the spiritual journey. And it's scary because we hold on to things not because, not only because perhaps we think they're wonderful, but because we're scared. So we have our judgments, we have our opinions, we have our strategies. Those are things that are important. We need to be very pragmatic in this life, but they're not the only things. And usually we grip them overly long because it's too vulnerable to be without our ideas about everything. I mean, I'm not saying I'm sorry for you. Me too. Of course, I just feel always compelled to say that. So the Mahayana teachings don't just say, oh, let go, you got this. Because it's not that easy, although I'm sure you've experienced moments of letting go, and you know on some level what I'm talking about already. But the Mahayana posits sort of two worlds of letting go. The first you could call relative letting go or relative love, relative awakening. And the second is called absolute. Absolute love, absolute compassion, absolute wakefulness. And though they don't sound related, at least to me, they are. So starting with relative love, or bodhicitta, as it's called in Sanskrit, awakened heart, means all the things we would imagine compassion means, and love, and relating with kindness to others. Being kind, being compassionate, certainly, being patient, not giving up, caring, being delighted by other people's joy. All of those, there are many teachings on these things in the Mahayana, and they fall, generally speaking, broadly speaking, under the heading of relative love. Like in this world, this relative world, how do we do these things? So there are countless teachings, extraordinary teachings. I'm going to just share very briefly a couple of them in a moment. But then there's the other way of understanding or practicing love in the absolute realm. And I can't really explain it too well because I don't understand it. But I can tell you what I have read and what I contemplate. So absolute bodhicitta, absolute love, includes relative love and all the things that, all the details and all the practices, but transcends all of that, goes beyond all of that, and plants you in the realm of non-conceptuality, where there actually is no you or me. I know that sounds, what? I mean, again, I can't explain it well because I have not attained realization. But I study this, I practice it. I think about it. I catch little glimpses of it from time to time, as I'm sure you do too. Absolute love, compassion is predicated on realizing, so not understanding, going beyond understanding to realize complete interdependence, that there is no separation between you and me. And that can be hard to understand because here I am, there you are. We're not the same thing. But in some realm, we are. And you can begin by thinking about yourself. What are you not separate from? Do you exist separate from anything? So I know that's a crazy question, but you would not be here without your parents. They would not be here without their parents. If one person in the line that gave birth to you died before giving birth, you wouldn't be here. In other words, you didn't get here in a spaceship. Who you are is comprised of other people, food you eat, environment you grew up in, and you can't separate yourself from those things. So in other words, you are an interdependent arising. And there's no way to even find where you begin and where you end. It's very confounding. So that's just something to think about. Another sort of thing that occurred to me some years ago about that was helpful to me in understanding the ununderstandable was something I realized about meditation practice. So often meditation is described as cultivating the inner observer. Now, bear with me for a moment. So that's cool. You're sitting there. You're observing your experience. At some point, you observe that you're spaced out and you let go and you come back and so on. But there's something in you that observes the observer observing you. I hope this doesn't sound too woo-woo. And then you can see yourself seeing yourself see yourself. And you can see yourself seeing yourself seeing yourself see yourself. Sorry, I know this sounds nutty. But in other words, there's no end. You don't find the original seer. Oh, that's me. I invite you to try. So there's some sense of continuity, and that's endless. Sometimes we or I might think, well, actually, I'm right in here, y'all. There's a little Susan behind my eyeballs or behind your earballs if you're visually impaired, that's where I am. And I'm in here, I'm looking out, I'm seeing things, I'm liking this, I'm not liking that. But sounds gross, but if I could look behind my eyeballs, there's not anyone in there. But here I am. Anyway, okay, I'm going to stop with the absolute notions. Let's suffice to say that the Mahayana is about the heart opening that occurs simultaneously on two levels, relative and absolute. If you want to study or contemplate the relative heart opening, which I really recommend, you could study things like the six paramitas or transcendent actions, generosity, discipline, patience, exertion, meditative absorption, and wisdom itself. Those are really worth studying. And somewhere here on this website, I've spoken about those things many times because I'm in love with them and I love talking about them. You could also study things like the four immeasurables, the four immeasurable qualities that you and I and all beings, not just all human beings, but all being beings, possess in unlimited quantity, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, my personal favorite, and equanimity. So those are just some examples of teachings within the Mahayana that take a very deep dive and a very practical deep dive into how to love. If you want to examine absolute bodhicitta, absolute love, you could study the Heart Sutra. It's called Prajna Paramita Sutra. Prajna means wisdom, paramita means transcendent. So the Transcendent Wisdom Sutra, which you do not have to do. I know it sounds very Buddhist-y, and it is, and it's worth it. And I have been chanting it, studying it, practicing it almost every day for probably 25 years. The Heart Sutra points to these truths that are beyond conventional knowing and relate very specifically to the truth of emptiness. Now, again, just to reiterate, emptiness doesn't mean everything is null and void and you're not there. You are there, but you're empty of separate existence. The Heart Sutra is maybe one of the most famous, absolutely central sutras, practices, teachings in the whole Buddhist path, but most particularly, I would say, in the Mahayana. And if you're interested, you could just Google Heart Sutra. I like the Nalanda translation, N-A-L-A-N-D-A. So if you Google Heart Sutra, Nalanda translation, you'll find it. It's short. It's a page and a half, equivalent of a page, maybe a full 8.5 by 11 page. And it has within it the Prajnaparamita mantra, the Heart Sutra mantra, the mantra that calms all suffering, as it is said, the mantra of great insight, the unsurpassed mantra, the unequaled mantra, the mantra that calms all suffering, is quoting from the Heart Sutra, should be known as truth, since there is no deception. The Prajnaparamita mantra is said in this way, Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Svaha. That's the mantra that calms all suffering, y'all. So highly recommended. Om, I'm sure you've heard Om. It's like, I'm not sure how it would be translated here. It's a seed syllable, so it defies translation. But it's something like, hello. Om, pay attention. Gate, gate, gone beyond, Paragate, gone way beyond. Parasamgate, gone completely beyond. Bodhi, awake. Bodhi means awake. Svaha, which sort of means mic drop. Boom. I just laid it down. Are you picking it up? Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Svaha. That's the Heart Sutra. That's the Prajnaparamita mantra. And if you now or in the future want to contemplate, study, or practice, most important, absolute bodhicitta, absolute love, this is the first and the last place I would suggest you go. It's personally very meaningful to me, so I might start crying, but I will try not to. The last thing I'll say about the Heart Sutra, should you read it, is the most important advice that I could give is don't try to understand it because it is beyond comprehension. I'm telling you that from personal experience. If you, sure, study it. What do these words mean? What is a skanda? What is samadhi? Why, who is Avalokiteshvara? All the things mentioned in the Heart Sutra. I'm not saying don't think about those or research those. That's a beautiful thing to do. But if you try to pierce with your intellect the meaning of the Heart Sutra, you will be repelled because it's impossible to understand with a conventional mind. I've tried. So as I mentioned, I've been practicing it for 25 years, y'all. I cannot say that I understand it. And I'm not being humble, on being truthful. However, my relationship to the Heart Sutra continues to deepen. It continues to teach me things. It continues to speak to me. It continues to pull on my heart. And I don't understand it. Just like a real relationship. When I look, for example, at my personal husband, I'm like, I don't understand that guy. I will never know who that guy is. But I know him intimately at the same time. And I love him. And he irritates me. And then it gets deeper. And then we become more distant. And then we find each other again. That is how it feels to be with the Heart Sutra. Never going to know it. But something deep is going on. So thank you for listening to me. It's a pleasure and a delight to speak with you. Whenever I get started doing one of these videos, I'm like, I don't know what to say. I don't have anything to say. And that's also true. But then I think about you, whoever you may be, and this longing to offer something of benefit wakes up. That when I'm just walking around in my own haze, I forget about. So thank you. Thank you for that. And let's practice meditation together. Let's sit together for 10 minutes. Our practice begins with the way we take our seat. And the basic idea is to sit up straight. Why? Because you're elegant and graceful and dignified. And when you sit up straight, you remember those things, which are always true, easily forgotten in this posture. Legs are crossed loosely in front, or if you're in a chair or on the couch, your feet can be flat on the floor, unless that is stressful, then just sit comfortably. The hands rest on the legs, palms down. And they're just resting. They're not working. Just take a break, y'all. Relax the front body. The belly can soften a lot. The area around the heart and lungs, the throat can soften. And let the shoulders relax. The chin is parallel with the ground. And the mouth is closed, but the lips and teeth can be slightly parted. The breath is natural, in and out through the nose. No breathing technique. You're already quite expert at breathing, so just continue, please. The eyes remain open and the gaze is cast down to a spot in front up to 6 feet, 2.5 meters-ish, or wherever feels comfortable given the distance of your screen. Let the eyes rest on a spot in front with the sense that whatever you're gazing at is coming toward you and you don't have to reach out for it particularly. There's a sense of receiving through the eyes. Let the forehead relax and the crown of the head reach up a little bit. Let the sit bones continue to reach down. Now let your attention come to rest on the breath, which means feel the breath rather than observe the breath. Be with the breath. Be the breath. Feeling the in-breath and the out-breath. Your mind will continue to make thoughts. That's not a problem. That's what it does. It's fine. Most of your thoughts will come and go on their own. No problem. Just let that be. Only if you notice that you have become fully absorbed in a line of thought to the point where you have forgotten completely about your breath, do you want to intercede? So first, notice that. Label it thinking. Then let go. Just let go. Doesn't matter what the thought is. Gently come back to this breath and take a fresh start, feeling the body breathe. So this is our practice, and we'll sit together in silence for a few minutes until you hear the bell. Thank you so much for your practice. Thank you for practicing with me. And thank you for practicing together.